It's The Takeaway for May 7th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're coming to you from WNYC's The Green Space today in front of a live studio audience. Woo! 1 year ago, I first hit the airwaves as host of this show. Now, a year later, I'm looking at three gaps in our society that I see as the root cause of many of the issues we cover: the wealth gap, the truth gap, and the empathy gap.
The best things that have happened in this country have been a product of the triumph of this democratic sense of empathy.
People feel so uncomfortable about race, and to discuss this is just a healing process, and we really need to heal as a nation.
We cannot imagine the other as part of ourselves.
These three gaps have gotten us to a challenging and some say unprecedented moment in U.S. history. So today we're talking about where we've made progress and where we think there's work to be done. As always, your voices are a part of the show.
My name is Nick, Philadelphia, PA. Probably one of the stories that Tanzina did from Puerto Rico. I've been listening to radio since I was a child, and I have to say Tanzina is one of the best radio hosts that I've ever listened to.
No time to waste. Let's do it live. Hi, everyone. It's The Takeaway Live, and we are coming to you from WNYC's The Green Space. We're broadcasting today in front of a live studio audience. What's up, New York City? We've got a lot of loyal New York listeners in the house today. This is my hometown. I appreciate y'all showing up. Thank you so much. We have a lot more of you listening from your hometown or your city, and we want to welcome you all as well. So it's exactly 1 year ago today that my voice hit the airwaves for the very first time as host of this amazing show, The Takeaway. Ah, the United States of America, land of the free, home of the brave, and lots and lots and lots of opinions on what it means to actually be an American. So, who am I? I'm Tanzina Vega. When I first sat in the host chair behind the mic a year ago, I outlined some of the gaps that I saw in this country that I felt had to be a part of the core mission of this show. These would become how we began to frame many of the issues that we cover here on The Takeaway. And let me tell you, this year, we've covered a lot of ground. But the three gaps that are most concerning to me are the following. Number one, the wealth gap. What that means is why some Americans are way more financially secure than others. Number two, the truth gap. Why we seem to have lost sight of the difference between opinion and fact. And number three, the empathy gap. Empathy gap? Yeah. Why do we seem to care more about the suffering of some people rather than others? You see, these three gaps have gotten us to a challenging, and some people would even call it unprecedented, moment in U.S. history. So let's talk about how much progress we've made or haven't made in these three areas. And we're going to start with empathy, okay? And just so we're all on the same page, here's how Dr. Sarah Conrath, who's an associate professor at Indiana University, describes empathy.
So emotionally, we feel empathy when we feel compassion and concern for others. And cognitively, we have empathy when we imagine their perspectives.
So the empathy gap that I'm describing exists when we can't or choose not to imagine the perspectives of other people. And so my question for this panel is, how do we start to close that gap? And I've got three guests on stage with me now who are all thinking about this issue in different ways. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer for The New Yorker who writes about race, politics, history, and culture. Jelani, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Javier Zamora is a poet and writer born in El Salvador and the author of the upcoming poetry collection, Unaccompanied. Javier, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Ziwe Fumudo is a comedian and writer for Showtime's Desus and Miro. Thank you for being with us, Ziwe.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so Jelani, we'll start with you. We heard from at the top from Dr. Sarah Conrath. She shows, and her research shows, that our empathy is declining.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening?
I mean, I think it's a very obvious symptom of the time that we're existing in right now. I mean, just yesterday we saw the president tweeting in defense of people who had been removed from social media for their belligerence. And I think that what has happened is that we've been kind of in a moment where we've been sold the idea of a zero-sum assessment of everything around us. if I get something, if you get something, it means that I don't. And what's created is an inability to have the kind of civic bond or civic connection that's fundamental to democracy. So all the things that we talk about, all the institutions and the Constitution and all these other kind of things, they begin with a fundamental presumption that you can see the interests of the other person in yourself. And you go back to the founders, and these are the same questions that they're asking. And so that's something that we are not doing very much of at this moment. I think it comes from the top. And at the same time, it's in some ways too easy to blame it on one person. That what we're seeing in the politics, in our politics now, is the culmination of processes that have been going on for years and years and years and years. And I think that this has been the kind of logical extension of them.
I'd love to hear also from Ziwei and Javier, like as a collective or as individuals here in this country, where is our empathy in this moment? Where do you see where the country stands, Javier?
I like going back to the definition, the focus on imagination. I think we ran out of imagination. I think we're just stuck into the same rhetoric and the same sorts of solutions. I think we need to think outside of the box, and I think we're not doing enough of it.
Ziwei, where do you think we are today?
With empathy? Mm-hmm. Horrible.
Tell me how you really feel.
Well, I think it speaks to the zero-sum game you refer to. Well, I see someone existing and there's widespread corruption. He gets whatever he wants. He doesn't have to break the rules, or he doesn't have to follow the rules. And so as an individual, you see someone succeeding, not following the rules, and you think, well, I don't have to follow the rules either. And then you have all these silos of people just being very selfish. And that's at the crux of empathy. Yeah. It's horrible. Everyone should be kinder.
Yeah. But there's also an idea that if I get something, what you were saying, then everybody else can. There's this selfishness that's happening. And as an immigrant, I think that that's where immigration goes into it. We can't all have it all because these immigrants are coming in and taking everything away from us.
Absolutely. It's an overarching idea that explains a lot of our politics. Mm-hmm. And so even when we're looking at things like voter suppression or the fact that we can actually countenance a policy in this country, and people will defend separating infants from their parents, something that is indefensible under any circumstance. But the only way that we can actually allow that to happen is if in some way we think that this person's relationship with their child is fundamentally different than my relationship with my child, or my neighbor's relationship with her child or his child. And that unwillingness to grant the same degree of humanity to people whom you don't know, who maybe live in a different part of the country, who worship differently than you, or have a different racial or ethnic background than you do, that unwillingness to do that has metastasized. And it's at the root of so many of the problematic things that we see now.
I think also, Jelani, you're a historian, and you've probably heard this before. This is something from W.E.B. Du Bois, the sociologist in the 1890s, that has always stood with me. And Du Bois here is describing how difficult, he says, the most difficult social problem in the matter of Negro health is the peculiar attitude of the nation toward the well-being of the race. But this is the part about what stuck with me. He says, there have been, for instance, fewer other cases in the history of civilized people where human suffering has been viewed with such peculiar indifference. Mm-hmm. The indifference to me is where the lack of empathy comes in, and I'm not understanding where that's coming from. Where do you think, Javier, in your work, you mentioned you're an immigrant to the country, how have you seen that indifference get stronger as being a Latino and being an immigrant in the United States?
I don't think it matters who the president is. As an immigrant, I've always felt the indifference towards immigrants. Even Obama, he's still the deporter in chief. He has deported more people than Trump still. And I will take it a step further and all the way back. Isn't this indifference part of what America was founded on and the country? This idea of the other, and that we are coming in here and the other, we cannot exist, and we cannot imagine the other as part of ourselves.
You were nodding your head, Ziwei. You think that?
that America exists on the idea of the other. Yes, this is in the fabric of who we are as a country. We started with free labor and being indifferent to human beings and treating them like property. So that's what this country is.
One of the things I think that's absolutely true as a historian, that is absolutely fundamentally true. The thing that I lament and that concerns me is that we have had, almost like the stock market, a rising and falling level of empathetic understanding. And so you have the institution of slavery, and you have people who understand that there has to be abolitionism. Or that you have labor exploitation, you understand that people have said that we have to have an 8-hour workday, or we have to abolish child labor, or any of the things that the best things that have happened in this country have been a product of the triumph of this democratic sense of empathy. And so that's what I'm talking about when I say that this moment is driven by this absence, is that we know that we're capable of this, or that the best of us. James Baldwin said that the world is held together by the love of a shockingly few small number of people. And that we know what that small number of people have been capable of doing. So this is not just the only option, that the institution that begins, the country that begins with the institution of slavery is doomed to always be what it once was.
And I also want to bring up the issue of language here, mm-hmm. right? Because language has played a really important role in, I think, this othering, Javier, that you're referring to. I'm thinking here, and I want to play a clip from David Livingston Smith. He's a professor of philosophy and the author of the book Less Than Human. And we interviewed Professor Smith around the time that President Trump had used what we would consider to be dehumanizing language to talk about whether it's MS-13 or other Latino immigrants. Let's take a listen.
Racialization arises out of conflict, exploitation, and oppression of human groups. So built into this sort of racial language are implicit ideas of superiority and inferiority. When you dehumanize people, you just push them one step further out of the category of the human entirely and into the twilight zone of subhumanity.
What do you think about that, Javier, in terms of your work and your lived experience?
I completely agree with it. And what Jelani was saying too, I feel like communication is also a part of why of the lack of empathy that we're having, and we're not listening to each other. And I'm wondering about how the news media is playing. Now we have like all technology, and it used to be like we can listen to one thing. And now we have a lot of different things. So to bring it back to that, I'm just hearing how even in the New York Times, and I've been doing some research regarding this, the images of children and their moms. We always only concentrate on the poor children and the mothers. But what about the fathers? What about the adults? And what about when the kid becomes an adult? Do we not care about that kid anymore? So there's like even other levels of dehumanization, even regarding the dehumanized.
And Ziwei, and I want to get into this in the next section, we're going to have to take a break soon, but you've also talked about how trauma is connected to your family and in leaving Nigeria.
Certainly. My parents are Nigerian immigrants. They came from Nigeria after the Biafra War, which was a civil war. My grandmother starved to death in her village. And so it's wild that I'm an artist and a comedian because the trauma is so heavy. And I still feel that in my like interaction with my parents now. You know, they have post-traumatic stress, but they'd never seek help for that because that's not the culture. So that actually deals a lot with how I have empathy. Because I see my parents through this like Americanized lens, and so I'm able to read about immigrants and feel related, like this could have been me if circumstances were different. Yeah, and so that's how I'm able to make art, is through the lens of like all this trauma that my parents suffered at the hands of colonization.
In talking about empathy, I might have mentioned this, Jelani, last week. I feel like in the United States we focus a lot on us, right? And we do us really well. It's all about me, me, me. But we don't do us really well. And what I'm doing for y'all that don't see me is the collective sort of signal here, the rest of us. How damaging has that been? I mean, I know we like to do us, but are we losing sight of this bigger collective? Ziwei, what do you think?
Certainly. I think you see that with the art that is made. If the people at the top look a certain way, certain artists don't get to have their voices heard. So that definitely helped. That definitely hurts the us. And if people don't have their voices heard, well, then you can't really see your voice reflected on television or movies or, you know, theater. So that hurts empathy.
And how do you make that work in your work? Because you do almost the opposite of what a lot of folks here do. You're looking at the funny side of things. You're trying to make people laugh. But is there empathy involved in that?
Laughing, yes. I think that comedy connects people, and being able to laugh, two different people being able to laugh at the same thing is just like, okay, well, we have something in common. Mm. So with my comedy, I race bait. Well, I do lots of different things.
You want to give them an example? You want to race bait me? I'll play along.
Okay, sure. Okay. Have you ever dated a black man?
Yes.
Wow, that's weird to objectify. horrible.
But I'm Puerto Rican, so does that count?
No, it doesn't. Love is love is love.
That's right.
The words of Lin-Manuel.
Exactly.
But yeah, I like to race bait because people feel so uncomfortable about race, and to discuss this is just a healing process, and we really need to heal as a nation.
I want to talk a little bit about also, you know, we're seeing in the news, we see a lot of moments, I guess, for empathy. And I want to bring up a couple of things that I think are newsworthy. The measles outbreak, for example. Mm-hmm. Are we showing empathy when we think about the way, you know, there are some folks who say, don't vaccinate your kids. Other folks, we now have one of the highest outbreaks of measles in the United States in decades. You know, is this a lack of empathy? What's happening at the southern border, for example? Is that a lack of empathy? Is that a lack of collective empathy? Is that a lack of empathy just from the administration? Notre Dame. Right? Mm-hmm. Burns. And there's so much going into Notre Dame, but does that mean there's a lack of empathy elsewhere? I'd love to open that up to the panel. Anyone wants to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think it's one, we know, like, people working in media know that there's this very it's an odd dynamic in which people can relate to a story or they can't. And sometimes it's geography, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's something that reaches out and grabs a person. Sometimes it doesn't. But I do think that there's been almost a kind of callousness, and going back to the point of what you said about being very me oriented, that, and I'm sorry to keep going back to the president, but I think it's just so like,
well, he's the
instructive
president.
About so many things. One of the things I think has been most disturbing was, you know, his tendency to ridicule people who've made great sacrifices on the behalf of others. Hmm. And I think that diminishes the possibility of service. It's almost like he treats people who suffer on the behalf of others as if they're suckers. Mm-hmm. And that was what I saw as the connection when he insulted John Lewis, the congressman from Atlanta, from Georgia, who very famously was bludgeoned nearly to death on Bloody Sunday in pursuit of the Voting Rights Act. And he also habitually, even posthumously, ridiculed John McCain. And so John McCain and John Lewis are very different people, but the thread that did tie them together was their willingness to suffer on behalf of others. And this is a person who said that he made no sacrifices. He couldn't point to anything he'd ever sacrificed in the interest of someone else. I think that is not maybe the cause, but I think it is exemplary of this bigger idea of how much we respect and how much we are able to honor the idea that that there are things more important than our personal gratification.
What does that do to us as a society? What does that do to us as Americans? That seeing that all the way from the top, because I do think it matters, right? Mm-hmm. What's all the way at the top and how that trickles down, not to suggest that it doesn't, you know, grow from the bottom up as well. But I'm just curious, Javier, what do you think that does for us as a society?
Well, I did mention that, you know, Obama and Trump, it doesn't really matter, but now I'm taking it back because it does matter.
They're different.
It definitely does matter because Obama would never blatantly said or did the things that Trump says. And as an immigrant, I still have undocumented people in my family. And the switch of the rhetoric that this president just blurts out now, my family is more scared than they were when Obama was president. So I feel like it's that fear of not being free. You know, as an undocumented person, you never feel free completely, but it's even worse now. It's heightened. Like they go to work and they don't know if ICE is going to show up. Mm. And now it's like an even heightened fear. The fear was already there. The fear has been there already, but now it's like increased.
So we're almost, we've got about a minute left in the segment, and I do want us to think about some positives here. At the same time, as I was putting together this segment, I thought, well, we have seen some empathy, right? We are seeing some movement forward when it comes to gender equality, when it comes to racial equality, when it comes to even people that set up GoFundMe accounts, right? And there are people that say, I can't pay my rent, and suddenly their rent is paid. Mm-hmm. That indicates empathy to me in some way, shape, or form. We got about a minute left, less than a minute left in the segment. Are we going to be all right? Z-Way.
We're doomed.
We're doomed. Javier, are we going to be all right?
If we're able to imagine and create and maybe get into art, yes, we will be.
I think if we're willing to be brave and willing to follow the best examples in our history, then yes, we will be.
You heard it here, folks. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer for The New Yorker who writes about race, politics, history, and culture. Z-Way Fumido is a comedian and writer for Showtime's Desus and Miro. And Javier Zamora is a poet and writer born in El Salvador and author of the collection Unaccompanied. Thanks to you all for this panel. We're coming to you from WNYC's The Green Space today, broadcasting in front of a live studio audience right in New York City. We just talked about the empathy gap here in the United States, and I think one of the reasons why there's this gap is also because we're all starting from different places, right? Literally, we're all starting from different places, and that brings me to the wealth gap. And here's what I mean when I talk about the wealth gap. In 2016, white families had the highest level of average family wealth. That was around $933,000. These are the latest numbers coming out of the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finances. But what happens when we talk about black families? Well, black families' average net worth is $138,000. That's 15% of white families. Latino families also have considerably less wealth than white families. What am I talking about when I talk about wealth? I don't mean how much you make. I'm not talking about your income. I'm talking about your assets, your cushion, your fallback, your house, all of the things that you own that provide wealth. The 1% in the United States, 95% white. So we're going to talk about the racial wealth gap. Andre Perry is here with me in the Green Space. He's a Brookings Institution fellow and author of the forthcoming book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in American Cities. Thank you for being with us, Andre.
Thanks for having me. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Andre, you know when we talk about money in this country and we talk about class and we talk about wealth, there's this working hard narrative.
Yeah.
Can we get that out of the way?
Yeah, you know, I often lead with a conversation by saying there's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism can't solve. That constantly we're trying to fix people into making or blaming people for this wealth gap by saying that they need financial literacy and they need to learn more and they need to work harder, when in fact we know that wealth was created by essentially the federal government bestowing some assets to others, particularly after the New Deal, in terms of housing policy, and denying it through redlining and racial housing covenants to black folk and brown folk. So this wealth gap was created principally by the federal government, and we talk about collusion a lot in these days, but it was also private organizations, mortgage companies participated in this horrible act. But let's not go back, because we reflexively talk about redlining and housing, but remember that blacks were assets that were owned by other people.
And this is something that we find really hard to acknowledge, to continue to acknowledge in this country, the economic impact of slavery.
Absolutely. That still has an impact today. Slavery, segregation, Jim Crow. I recently did a study that looked at housing prices in black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods. And after controlling for education, crime, walkability, and all these fancy Zillow scores that you you find, that we found that homes in black neighborhoods are worth 23% less, about $48,000 per home, $156 billion in lost equity across the country. I mean, that amounts to about 4.4 million startup businesses, if you look at the average startup for black businesses. That would equate to about 8 million college degrees. It would have replaced the pipes in Flint, Michigan 3,000 times. That $156 billion in lost equity was caused by slavery, segregation, and Jim Crow. And it still haunts us today. So we have got to have solutions to this.
Andre, we're talking about closing this gap. I've written stories, and there's been research that says it's going to take more than 200 years to close this racial wealth gap. That's outrageous.
No, but I put this.
You disagree.
I disagree, because the same way we created wealth for white Americans, we can create wealth for people who were disadvantaged by those same policies. So when we're talking about redlining, those communities still exist. We can create metrics. Interestingly, there's so much talk about reparations. If you look at Georgetown University, they created a reparation package for their formerly enslaved employees there. Well, not employees, workers there. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that you can't create a wealth-building opportunity for those negatively impacted over generations is a falsehood. We have too much data. I, for one, looked at devaluation in black communities, but we also can look at the various other workarounds to solve this problem. And if you're looking at a 2020 candidate who's really interested in solving this problem, see if their policies are directly trying to combat racism, segregation, slavery. If they don't mention those things, then it's not a sincere policy.
We should also be clear that we're not just talking about wealth in a black and white framework. There are also Latino Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans who are also left out of this of the spoils of wealth, if you will. One thing that's always stood out to me is the unemployment rate for Latinos is very low right now. And yet, when you look at the racial wealth gap and you add gender to it, Latinas are still the lowest paid of all women, period. All women. Look, so what does that tell us, Andre? We're working, but we're not getting paid?
Brown and black women are at this nexus of gender inequality and racial inequality. They have a particular vantage point on how both these structural issues impact folks. So yes, in many cases, you can see people of color in a state of what we call full employment. But their wages are so abysmally low. It's because they're being exploited in that employment. So you should not want for just employment. You should want for shared prosperity with employment to go along with.
And I want to talk a little bit about, because this is now becoming part of the political dialogue for 2020, right? I've never heard candidates talk about racial wealth gap, reparations, and now everybody's got this on their these talking points. But I am seeing something interesting happening, and I'm wondering if you can speak to it. AOC, whether you like her or don't, one of the things that she's been talking a lot about is uniting the working class, right? Do you see, we are seeing labor changing in the United States. We're seeing rising labor movements. Government shutdown had an impact on American workers. Teacher strikes across the country. Lyft and Uber drivers are going on strike as we tomorrow. Is that the solution to closing this wealth gap more immediately?
Oh, it's definitely a part of the solution. We need folks to mobilize. If people do not mobilize, then we're at a disadvantage in terms of changing power. We're not going to wait for CEOs to figure out that structural oppression will deteriorate the livelihood of most Americans. We need to force them to see. And so I'm all for mobilization in these ways.
And you think this is something that we're going to see more of in the future? Do you think there's labor movement, particularly among people of color, is viable?
Absolutely. You saw it with the teachers. And let me, in red states, in right-to-work states, where you can essentially fire folks without recourse, you see white teachers. Now, they say when white people catch a cold, black folk catch pneumonia. That's sort of the axiom there. And so if white folk are stepping out and saying, hey, I'm not earning wages. Guess what? There's a whole lot of folks who will be willing to step out and demand their proper due.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Andre Perry is a Brookings Institution fellow and author of the forthcoming book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in American Cities. Thank you, Andre.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Susan from Vashon Island, Washington. There are so many great stories from Tanzina's first year. She's doing a fabulous job as host of The Takeaway. One story that stuck with me is the one she did about women in business and how we manage to get paid fairly. I try never to miss a show because she is so thorough in her investigative reporting. Congratulations on your first year, Tanzina.
The series on manhood was so important, eye-opening, and well done. We need so much more coverage of these issues in our society.
Hi, this is Monica from Corvallis. I really enjoyed the series about why people don't vote. I'm a graduate student, and my thesis is exploring just that. It was very helpful and exciting to hear those episodes.
So excited to be here on my one-year anniversary. Thank you so much. And boy, has it been a year. That's why we thought it was really important to end this special hour talking about one of the most important issues to me as a journalist, the truth gap. Susan Shira is with me on stage. Susan is the editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project. But before that, she spent about 38 years as a reporter and senior executive at the New York Times. And I was your intern once a long time ago. Susan, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's great to be here. And congrats on an amazing year, Tanzina.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So we can't, I mean, we talked a lot about President Trump and truth. We can't just begin and end it there. I mean, this is something that was happening before 2016, right?
That's absolutely right. I think that what you identify as the truth gap is a very, very disturbing trend that's started a long time ago, but has accentuated. And, you know, the really scary thing as a citizen and as a journalist is how many Americans, both from the left and the right, have trouble distinguishing what we would call facts from opinion, but also interpret facts based on their political perspective. And, you know, as a journalist, you're taught to revere facts. And what is really concerning is that this respect for facts, I mean, truth is even a larger question, but we'll stick with facts, is foundational for democracy and for understanding and sifting through deliberate misinformation and propaganda.
Last year, Pew actually looked at the issue of whether or not Americans can discern fact from fiction, and this is concerning because the results were not good. They did a survey of 5,000 U.S. adults and asked people to distinguish between five factual statements and five opinion statements. 36% of the people who were surveyed who said that they had a high level of political awareness were able to correctly identify all factual statements. 36%. Not a good sign. What does that tell? Is this our fault? What is this, the education? What's going on here, Susan?
Yeah, this is a really disturbing fact and unsurprising, sadly, to those of us in journalism. And that's because of many, many things, right? I think that there's a distrust in the news media, which sadly the news media needs to own too. There's been a sense, you know, when you talk about the empathy gap and you talk about the wealth gap, those things, you know, contribute to the fact that different groups of people have felt unrepresented, unheard, and unportrayed on the right and the left, right? Or, you know, from different constituencies, if you will. And so, one, there's this increasing distrust that somehow the reality people live, they don't see reflected at them back. There's the deliberate stoking of misinformation, which, of course, did not start with the Trump administration, but they're a kind of fine, dark acts practitioner of it. I mean, when you have Sarah Sanders, you know, admitting with no shame that she just made things up, you know, and you have the president tweeting continuously things that are factually demonstrably wrong, and you have to look at an ecosystem that produced it. And part of that is the rise of ideologically polarizing news outlets you know, you have Fox News, but you also have, you know, outlets on the left that will spread what you might call myths that aren't necessarily factually demonstrable. So you have an ecosystem that kind of presented truth as people would like to see it to those who wanted to believe it. And then,
but
I think the third thing, which of course we saw come out in the 2016 election, is the deliberate misrepresentation by, say, the Russians and other actors who were trying to stoke political division, racial division, ethnic division by masquerading as news. And the deliberate planting of misinformation through kind of cyber attacks and others is another factor that keeps us misinformed and at each other's throats.
And it just, it's infuriating, I think, to think about how, like, why couldn't we, the media, or we, the American public, see that more clearly? What happened that we just decided that we were going to go along with that, that it worked? Was it the political moment that just helped?
I think there are many things. You know, obviously, political polarization has deepened. You know, each side thinks the other is not just wrong, but often evil. And so when you have that degree of emotion, it also becomes, like, important for people to believe certain things, important to their sense of justice and fairness and representation, as we discussed. So I think you have, one, you have political passions at a boiling point. But you also have sort of the campaigns of various organizations to try to, you know, the birther question with President Obama, other, just the repeating, relentless repetition of lies that then get sold as truth.
Do we, because I think we as the media also need to take responsibility here, do we need to do a better job at labeling the way we label things? And you and I both know from the New York Times, there was a meticulous process of where things went, what the headlines said, what they didn't say. Are we not doing as good of a job at that anymore?
You know, it's interesting. When I was at the New York Times, one of the things that I did with my colleagues is we spent nearly a year looking at our audience and who reads us and what they think and who they are. And one of the things we found that was discouraging is that even many of our readers didn't take the labels in that separated news and opinion. They didn't see the distinction. That, of course, is partly because the news media has changed. What used to be a way of writing news stories that was very on the one hand, on the other hand, and kind of straightforward, that became insufficient in a world. For example, if you look at climate change, it's not sufficient to say one side believes this and one side believes that, because the facts point otherwise. So things got more interpretive. And as they got more interpretive, they also, the line between news and opinion, I think, in the public eye got blurred.
Susan, we've been talking about the truth gap. And I want to bring up this idea that Christiane Amanpour talks about a lot. And she says, we journalists should be truthful and not neutral. Is that what you're describing when you say our journalism has shifted to from this, on the other hand, on the one hand model?
I think I understand exactly what Christiane is saying. I still believe in the value of not taking a political opinion and really examining your own assumptions to make sure that your own idea of what the truth is carefully fact-checked. But I think that what I was trying to explain is I think that people have become, the line that used to be much clearer between news and opinion has become blurred in readers' minds. And I also think what I was trying to say with, say, climate change or with the Trump presidency, the difficulty is, when the president of the United States says something that is demonstrably factually untrue, the news media must, in my opinion, call him on it just as you would any public figure. And so, and yet you don't want to be, at least at the New York Times and other mainstream news organizations, you don't want to be seen as the opposition to the president. You don't want that calling someone on factual misstatements to be seen as a kind of political statement. And so it's a difficult dilemma.
And oftentimes that comes up in the language itself. I mean, the president has called the media, you know, the enemy of the people. We talked about language in our previous segment. In terms of language here, phrases like truth decay, alternative facts, fake news. This language, I think, seriously hurts us.
I think it's a terrible crisis because, you know, as the publisher of the New York Times, A.G. Sulzberger, told President Trump directly, when he calls the news media the enemy of people or lying, you know, news outlet A, B, or C, he's actually labeling them as un-American and encouraging attacks against them. Journalists are facing dangers they have not faced before. You look at the appalling shooting in Baltimore. Annapolis, pardon me. You look at the idea that he's also enabled autocrats around the world to use those similar phrases in labeling their own news media as traitors. This is deeply disturbing.
I do want to talk a little bit also about the need for media literacy in the United States, which is something I think is lacking. I'm going to take a little bit of a, maybe somewhat of a defensive stance here as a journalist who traffics in this stuff all day. I think, you know, we hear a lot about, I'm wondering how much does the public need to be better educated about what we do versus journalists needing to show what we do more? Because a lot of it is, well, show your work, show your process, be more transparent, answer all the questions on Twitter, you know. And I think that there comes a point at which journalists have to be trusted as professionals who work with a code of ethics and standards, at least in mainstream media, and accountability. I could lose my job if I lie. I could lose my job if I do certain things that are journalistically unethical.
I think it's a combination. I do agree that, you know, news literacy is something that's become more urgent. It should really be taught in every school. It should be part of, you know, elementary school education, because it's objectively harder for citizens to tell the difference now. Let's not forget the deliberate misinformation, the social media becoming a kind of maelstrom of passion and emotion. I mean, I think it's harder than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And we don't have, you know, I'm going to date myself, but when I was a kid, Walter Cronkite was kind of like Uncle Walter. You, when you saw him on TV, you trusted him. Those figures don't exist anymore because there's a cacophony. I mean, blogging and
tweeting
and all these other forms have kind of blurred these distinctions. So one, I have empathy, if you will, for the consumers of news. But I also think that what also happened is anyone could be a journalist, right? And actually, journalists are trained. They are a profession and they are taught to observe certain codes. So yes, I hope we can deepen the trust and earn back the trust. And yes, I think people need help distinguishing and assessing what's true and what's not.
How do we as journalists decide, and these are conversations that you've had every day, we have them every day, we'll probably have them today after this show, deciding what we're going to cover tomorrow. You know, deciding what to cover and what to ignore when everything feels like a constant, you know, nonstop assault of information. How do we decide what to do?
I know. It's a constant dilemma. And you're always, you know, I was in the position of helping to make decisions about what the New York Times covered and didn't cover. And I was always second guessing myself, as you try to do, to be intellectually honest. I think on the one hand, the fact that we have social media. You look at, say, you know, what's colloquially called Black Twitter, or you look at the advent of the ability on cell phones to capture incidents of racism. So there are things that used to be ignored that are now put out that are important for us as a society to confront. But you also wonder about the deluge, and people get overwhelmed and tuned out. So there isn't a firm rule or an easy way to summarize it. But yes, it's hard to sort through. And we have to make sure that our own assumptions are challenged, as I said before, so we make sure we're covering a wide range of perspectives and events.
We've got about a minute left in the segment. I just want to, you know, you are continuing to do this work. I am continuing to do this work. So many of us are. Can we end on a hopeful note here? Is there? I mean, if there isn't, we can handle that
yes,
too.
Yes, I absolutely refuse to give up on the idea that we can build trust back in the news media. I believe that one thing that has happened is that the average citizen has, I think, become more aware of the importance of deeply resourced news media to do investigative reporting, to hold the powerful to account, to expose injustice in every way. I believe people understand better than they did a few years ago why a free press is so important.
And we hope that you all appreciate that as well. Susan Shira, thank you so much. Editor-in-Chief of the Marshall Project, 38 years as a reporter, senior executive at the New York Times. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much to our audience for joining us live in the studio. Thanks to the Green Space for hosting us. And of course, I want to take the opportunity to thank my team who helped make this show what it is and make it happen every single day. Isabel Angel, Beenish Ahmed, Alex Boti, Jay Cowett, Vince Fairchild, Ellen Frankman, David Gable, Rob Gunther, Amber Hall, Polly Irungu, Lydia Jean Cott, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, and Jason Tureski. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
My name is Nick. I live in Philadelphia, PA. Probably one of the stories that Tanzina did from Puerto Rico. I've been listening to radio since I was a child, and I have to say Tanzina is one of the best radio hosts that I've ever listened to. Thank you so very much for all the hard work Tanzina and her crew bring to the airwaves.
Hi, this is George from Berkeley, Massachusetts. I really liked your show last Thanksgiving about how to sit around the Thanksgiving table with people that have different political opinions from yourself and be able to make it through dinner without any blood being spilled. So I really like that show. Keep up the good work, guys.